This will be a special about an organization that's called ECCJ, which is in this case not the Energy Conservation Center in Japan or the European Cigar Cult Journal from Austria, but it's the European Coalition for Corporate Justice. And there are two people we're going to talk with, and that's Jérôme Charpier, I pronounce your name correctly?
That's very well pronounced.
Who is the coordinator? And then a steering group member, Paul de Klerk.
Yeah, correct.
So, what's the problem? I mean, this organization was founded because there's a problem.
Maybe I can start because I was involved in setting up the organization. Mm-hmm. So, we set up ECCJ about 10 years ago. We're going to have our 10th anniversary actually this autumn. And that was done by a number of groups, a number of organizations which are working on impacts of companies, mostly in developing countries, negative impacts in terms of human rights violations, environmental degradation, social problems, and the like. And all of the organizations were working on that already for a long time, trying to push companies to stop certain misbehavior or to push them in the right direction. But at a certain point, we also realized that this is a kind of, how do you call it in English? Dweilen met de kraan open. It's not English, but it's kind of firefighting, but not really addressing the real problem.
Just addressing the effects,
cause,
but not
yes.
Basic cause. Yes.
So what brought us together was at some point a realization that it's not enough just to push companies or to discredit them or to talk with them or to name and shame them or whatever kind of approach you would be using, but actually we thought that there is a need for also binding obligations for companies to behave properly, and if they are not behaving properly, then it should also be possible to hold them accountable and punish them if necessary, and victims of these abuses should have a good and easy channel to go to court. And this was something that we had been demanding at the national level in various countries already for a while. Mm-hmm. But you always get the answer, this is not something we can do on our own, this needs to be done at the European level. So that's the reason why 10 years ago that we decided to set up ECCJ. It was clearly based on the idea that voluntary commitments of companies are not going far enough. And we need binding obligations, we need corporate accountability framework at the European level and ideally also at the international level.
Yes, because the European level wouldn't be enough, I think. There is a kind of globalization in the world now, so there are firms that are based maybe on one side of the world and working on another part of the world. So there would be need for global legislation.
Yeah, but when we talk about European legislation, mm-hmm. that would cover the activities of European companies outside Europe. So it would mean that if an extractive industry company is causing problems somewhere in Africa, then it should be possible to hold them accountable in Europe. So that victims of that company could come to Europe, for instance, to take them to court in a European court.
The fact that in the current globalization, the transnational companies are using very complex structures, operating with European headquarters, tens of or hundreds of suppliers, subsidiaries, that's precisely why an organization like ECCJ is needed, because we need to have the rules that will help bridge some gaps in the national, European, international frameworks. There are still situations where victims, due to the corporate structure, but also due to the lack of appetite in these countries in the developing world, or lack of capacities in these countries to truly ensure justice for victims. Mm-hmm. So we need to be looking at, of course, at some national legislations, because that's where companies have headquarters. Many of the laws that can help victims are decided at national level, but also many are actually being more and more discussed at European level. And even though there would be improvements here in Europe, there would still be situations where some international action is needed, mm-hmm. precisely because we're talking about really international operations.
Now, if a company is doing something wrong in a developing country, then isn't it the responsibility of the government of this developing country to protect its citizens? What business is it of ours?
In the first place, it's the responsibility of the government in that country, because The government has a duty to defend or make sure that the rights of its own citizens are not being violated. The problem is that often in a lot of countries, the government is either not willing to do that.
Why not?
Because, for instance, they're closely cooperating actually with that company. A lot of big companies, for instance, in the area of land acquisitions or in the area of extractive industries or in the area of producing clothes, are very closely working together with these companies. They're creating an investment climate that makes it attractive for these companies to come there and to invest. Often the government is even in a joint venture with the company because they've done a lot of effort to get the company there, and they're very often unwilling to punish the company if they do something wrong. That's one reason.
So you mean that the company can go to several countries, and several countries are in competition to get the company to come to their country?
Yes, I mean, it's not always the case, because if you have natural resources, then you cannot say, I go to another country if that doesn't have it. But in a lot of industry, the companies are playing out countries against each other, and they can say, look, if you don't create good conditions for us, then we go to another country, or if you punish us, or if your environmental or labor standards are too high, we just move to another country. You see that with the garment industry. China has been, or in a lot of areas, China was very popular. Now the salaries in China are increasing, and companies are moving out again, and they're going to Vietnam or to Bangladesh or to other countries. That's one reason. The other reason is often that actually countries just lack the capacity, even if they would be willing, they lack the capacity to hold a multinational company to account. Because in some of the areas, the companies are bigger than the country itself. They have a turnover which is, especially if you look at the oil and gas companies, they are sometimes bigger than the whole national product of that country. So even if they would be willing to hold them accountable or take them to court, it's not possible. Or a third reason is that in a lot of countries the level of corruption is so high that even if you go to court, you're never going to win it. The judges are bribed.
So that's the idea of justice, then the richest wins.
Yes. Or the processes are dragging on forever. You can go to court for 10 years, but which individual citizen can afford to go to court? We had cases, for instance, of people in Nigeria who took Shell to court there. And after 5 years, basically, they had to stop the court case because it was still ongoing, and normal people cannot afford to do that. Shell was appealing and appealing and appealing and appealing, and on every procedural ground. And in the end, the people that we did the case with and ourselves, we just didn't have resources anymore to continue the court cases. And that's what especially big multinational companies, they can just sit it out, and then they can just wait until the other side stops the case.
Has to give up.
And that is one of the important reasons why there is impunity. Of course, going to court, like we did 5 years later, we went to court with Nigerian farmers against Shell in the Netherlands. This is also not an easy case, and it's not a short case either. But at least we have the expectation that if the court in the Netherlands decides something, Shell will have to oblige. We saw that the court in Nigeria said that it was about gas flaring done by Shell. And the court actually said this is a violation of human rights of people living around these flares and it should stop. Nothing happened. Shell just continued.
So you learn from what is not working to find a new approach that might be working.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, well, we hope this also now in the Netherlands, Shell is appealing the last decision of the court a year ago, which said that at least in one of the cases they will have to pay compensation for the oil spills and the damage that they caused. But this case will continue, and it might take another 1 or 2 years before it finally comes to a decision. But we also seen a similar case in the UK. And in the UK, it's a bit of a different system, because in the UK, you can have class actions. So that means that one court case can represent thousands of people. So what happened in the UK was that a law firm, they took on a case on behalf of 15,000 people in a community that was destroyed by an oil spill by Shell. They went to court in the UK. And in the end, Shell didn't want to let it get to a final decision, so they made a settlement with the community. But they paid something like, if I'm correct, more than 50 million euro to the community. While the first offer of Shell to that community was 5,000 euro.
Okay.
that were going to court in the UK helps.
So you also had an illustration of...
Yeah, I mean, we know that there are so many legal, financial or procedural obstacles for victims. And there was one example which is linked to workers' rights to show how difficult it is to get justice. It's a company called Comilog, which was active in Congo, Brazzaville and Gabon. And in 1991, 24 years ago, there were almost 1,000 workers abusively dismissed. They didn't get any notice on compensation. And at national level in Congo, in Gabon, they tried to get remedy, to get justice, mm-hmm. and they faced insurmountable obstacles to assert their rights. And finally, in 2007, with support of French lawyers, the case was brought to the French Tribunal for Employment, because Comilog is a subsidiary of a French parent company. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, in 2011, the tribunal finally concluded it had no competence over such case. But in June 2013, 2 years later, the Court of Appeal finally accepted jurisdiction on such case of social legislation with an extraterritorial dimension. So it took 21 years, and it's still at a stage that the Court of Appeal has said, yes, indeed,
we can judge.
So it highlights some of the obstacles very clearly. We have lengthy procedures, 24 years and still pending. Unavailability of class actions, because there 868 separate claims have been filed because mm-hmm. there couldn't be one single claim for the almost 1,000 workers. There were high costs that the victims can't really bear without support of NGOs or pro bono lawyers because there's mm-hmm. no legal aid. And there's still a legal uncertainty about the jurisdiction. Where is it that I can bring my claim? Mm-hmm. If not in Gabon, if not in Congo, if not in France. And that's the reality. And still, this coming of case, if you take to talk to some NGOs, would still be considered as a successful one. Because at least after 24 years, there's still a possibility that they will get justice. I think that says a lot about really where the issue is. Mm-hmm. It's about people there not being able to basically exercise their rights.
Mm-hmm. And your question was also, why is it our business? Well, it's because it's companies from our countries.
Yes.
And they also, the companies say, we don't have double standards. We operate the same in Africa as we do in our own country.
That's
what they should, and that's also what they say that they are doing, but in reality they're not.
Okay.
And we're saying, okay, you are accountable here. It should be possible to hold you accountable in your country. And first of all, because they are more receptive to pressure in their own country as somewhere in the country far away. And secondly, because it's often the legal structures are better to hold them accountable. If you can get a fine, for instance, in the Netherlands of a Dutch company or in the UK of a UK company, then it's more effective if they are being trialed for some African mm-hmm. countries.
But then again, why should it be our problem? I mean, if they don't misbehave in Europe and go and misbehave elsewhere.
But it's about decisions made in Europe. It's not like there's a big separation and you have these headquarters, these parent companies here, and then decisions made, I don't know, in Congo, in Bangladesh, in Vietnam. It's about decisions made here by people in headquarters in Europe that mm-hmm. truly affect the life of people. And mm-hmm. very often these decisions are made without any care, without mm-hmm. any diligence to check, okay, what is going to be the impact of investing there, of drilling to find oil there?
Well, a higher return and more profits for the shareholders, of course. Isn't that great? I mean, just tell me, why should we care?
Because we have a responsibility. These companies are, in most of the cases, they're producing the products that we are using. So mm-hmm. it's the oil and gas that we're using. It's the clothes that we're wearing. It's the food that we're eating. Mm-hmm. If our products, the products that we're using, if they are linked to human rights violations, to, mm-hmm. to environmental problems, to climate change, then I think we have a responsibility to make sure that this doesn't happen.
There's indeed a moral responsibility, and it's important. It's an important driver to change the situation. There's also a legal responsibility. I mean, there are international bills for human rights. There are plenty of conventions of the international labor organizations that say this is what is acceptable and not acceptable in the international law when it comes to...
So those standards do exist already?
There are standards. The issue often is how they are enforced. I mean, the International Bill for Human Rights is a great instrument, it's a very inspiring instrument. Is it an instrument that would allow someone in Congo who's being hurt when working without a contract in a mine, would this really help this person get justice? There's a missing link there, which is the rule of law, which is available courts, which is about clear liability standards for companies. This is what is missing, and this is what the whole work of passing the adequate laws, legislations here in Europe is about.
So the idea is that you are putting pressure on Europe to pass such laws, but the final goal would be to make those laws international, I suppose, because if only in Europe the climate becomes more strict for companies, they will just leave Europe, won't they?
Yeah, so ultimately we want rules that cover the whole world. And that's also why recently we started to work also on the global level. There is a process at the UN level, which is about establishing a treaty on business and human rights that started in Geneva a little bit more than a year ago. And the goal of that is to set global standards, standards on environment, on human rights, on social issues, but also standards to allow that companies are held accountable and that you can take them to court and all of these kind of things. ECCJ is also working on that now, and our role is specifically to actually pressure the European institutions and member states, because those are the ones which are blocking that process.
Are they?
Yes, they are.
At the UN level, they are blocking it.
Yeah, there was the first meeting this summer in Geneva, and on the first day, the turnout of the European states was just a few out of 28. We had, I think, on the first morning, 8 or 9 member states in the room. In the afternoon, there were just 4 or 5. And on the second day, basically, there was just one French intern, an intern from the French delegation in the room. So it's not only about the numbers. I mean, clearly the numbers show a lack of appetite for having this kind of international treaty being discussed in the UN. But it's also all the maneuvers, all the attempts they had to really try to derail the process. They came with conditions that they knew would really create some huge political difficulties to get the process going. So in the end, the meeting went on. It was a good meeting, but every participant noticed how the EU was really not a constructive player, really didn't come in good faith, thinking we have issues, and many states have issues about how a big international instrument like this should look like, but you need to start discussing, you need to sit together, to negotiate, to find a solution. And it was really about an empty chair policy, which I think, when you think about how Europe is one of the key players in history and still currently in defending human rights worldwide, that's really a policy that is not acceptable for the European citizens and our values, but also for all the people across the world affected by the operations of European companies.
Now, I noticed you said we had so many countries in the room. What do you mean with we? Were you actively involved in preparing those meetings then?
It's an intergovernmental process. So basically, we have representatives of the member states sitting. The process has started in quite an open way, in the sense that civil society organizations have been in the room, have been able to share suggestions, to comment. But in the end, it's about states agreeing on such an instrument. It's about states ratifying such an instrument. But civil society really has been pushing for this and really wants to be a partner in these discussions. We are the organizations who are capable of bringing the concerns, the voices of those affected in these discussions. And when I say we, I'm not necessarily saying the European NGOs. We mean civil society from Asia, from Latin America, from Africa. And there in Geneva, it was really good to see tens, I would say hundreds of people coming from all over the world to really show a clear signal, we need this treaty.
So, and you were there then, and you were representing, in fact, the whole of the European social actors?
No, I don't think we can claim to represent the whole of European social actors. I mean, at ECCJ, we represent our member groups, which are national platforms in some 10, 15 countries. I was also there on behalf of Friends of the Earth. And there were a lot of other groups from Europe, from Brussels, from member states.
who are not part of ECCJ?
Some of them are part of ECCJ as well, like FEDH or SOMO from France and the Netherlands, but others like CITSI, which is an NGO representing Catholic aid organizations, they were there as well. They were also pleading for such a treaty. And also organizations like FION, which is an international food action network. So it is a very broad spectrum of organizations, but of course we can't claim to represent everyone.
Because if I understand correctly, you started because you thought that you would have a better impact on the European level if you would unite and coordinate your actions.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's about being able to bring a common voice, common propositions, to make the link between some debates that are still taking place at national level and bring them to the European level. I think one interesting example is a recent reform on companies' transparency. How much should companies disclose how they impact human rights, they impact environment, how they're involved in corruption, or there's a risk of corruption in their activities. And it started with just two member states out of 28 having national legislations. And by starting already 6 years ago, not only CCJ, but with some partners, including the trade union movement and consumers organizations, by saying we need it to be happening in more than just one or two states, ultimately last year there was a directive adopted which will make it mandatory. And the latest figures I got is that in the end more than 9,000 companies across Europe would be obliged now every year to publish a report on their main risks that they have on human rights, on environment. So it's really showing that sometimes the developments can start at in a few member states, but at some point, if you really want to have an impact, we have to bring it to the European level, and that's where we can start talking about thousands of companies, and hope that within 5 years we'll be talking about even more companies.
Which countries are those two?
It was Denmark and France. We started to have the first binding rules for disclosure of, we call it non-financial information. Companies are obliged already for years and years to publish some financial information every year, but there was so far absolutely no obligation to say how you affect society, basically. That's how it is. It's about consumers, shareholders, workers, civil society, investors. Everyone should know how companies have an impact on society.
Now, they are writing reports. Who's checking if those reports are true? I mean, they can write anything, can't they?
So far they can. That's one of the big challenges with the directive. So
now we create, I can write a beautiful report for you.
Glossy reports, they call it sustainability reports or CSR reports. That's already there. We can find easily on the internet hundreds of examples.
CSR is corporate social responsibility.
Yeah, we're not such big lovers of CSR because the idea that companies have social responsibilities is good. But over time, CSR has become a very broad concept
used by a
marketing tool. It's driven mostly by voluntarism. It's a business-driven concept. It's about companies telling society, look, we
how
are in the best position to say what we do, what we should do, and how great we are in the end. So CSR is mostly a marketing tool, but still that's how all the discussions are framed at the moment in Europe. So we try to reframe the discussion.
Instead of talking about a responsibility of companies, we're talking about companies have to be accountable. And accountable implies that it's not something that they can choose to do or not do. No, it's something that they have to do.
And so if they don't do it, there will be repercussions.
Yes. But this work that we're doing, I mean, obviously it's not a short, easy road. It's a long-term struggle. We started 10 years ago. And from the beginning, we had basically three priorities. Those were the issue of companies have to publish their impacts. They have to be transparent about that. The second issue was that victims of companies need to have a better way to go to court. If it's not possible in their own country, then in the country where the company is coming from. And the third one, companies need to have an obligation to take care for what they're doing. And if they are not taking care for what they're doing, if they're creating all kinds of problems, then it should be possible to take them to court to hold them accountable. These were the three issues from the beginning. 10 years down the road, we managed to get one of the three through. And that's the directive from last year. Companies have to report now. That's a legal obligation. On the other two, there's still a long way to go, and that has a lot to do with the fact that there is an enormous counter-lobby from the business side against what we will want to achieve. And also, it's not just the business side, but it's also so much kind of in the political culture of the last 10 years that everything should be done to make it as cheap and easy for companies to operate and let them all decide to do it on their own way, let companies themselves manage their impacts, etc. And, well, we've seen some interesting example of that in the last week with the whole Volkswagen issue, where actually it's a bit more complicated because actually there is a standard, and there were standards for companies for lowering their emissions, but then it was left up to the companies themselves to make sure that they comply with it and to arrange the testing of the cars. And that again proves very clearly that if there is so much money at stake, then you cannot leave it up to companies to decide themselves, because they will bend the rules and they will try to do it in the cheapest way possible, and that can include that they will act fraudulous or they will impact on the human rights of people or they will destroy the environment.
Mm-hmm. There is so much impunity that maybe, I hope within a few months we'll be looking at this Volkswagen case by saying, well, that's a good example of states refusing to let companies cheat, somehow reclaiming power on companies and sanctioning. So I hope there actually will be a lot of cases in courts. We'll have a lot of sanctions, because it will be a clear signal that when it comes to respecting environmental or social legislations, no fraud could ever be accepted. Mm-hmm. And that's probably going to be the case in Europe, in the US. The question is, what if Volkswagen cheated in similar tests in Asia, in Africa, taking advantage of sometimes lower standards, mm-hmm. or like we said before, governments were trying to be quite friendly to companies willing to invest there, what would happen? So talking about double standards, clearly there would be a case of double standards between society being affected in Europe, and then you would have sanctions, most probably, and then people being affected outside of Europe. For some of them, they're never going to see anything like a sanction or a remedy.
But you say now that scandals are good in a way, because they make things move.
Yeah, we need scandals. I mean, the example is also with what we have achieved. That was the legislation on the obligation for companies to report on their impact. This actually came from the previous scandal, which was the whole financial sector problem, where the whole financial crisis, where banks and investors were actually also doing whatever they wanted, and then almost the economy broke down. And that triggered a realization within governments for a short while, within governments and also within the European Commission, that actually it's not good to leave it up to the voluntary steps of companies. And then one of the commissioners started an initiative for this obligation for reporting. And that's through a scandal that we got that. But after that, the lobby from the business side starts kicking in again, and the immediate pressure goes away after 1 or 2 years. And then the whole ideology of letting companies do it themselves comes back again. This scandal hopefully will again be leading to some improvements. But yeah, I'm sure that the counter lobby is already thinking of how they can neutralize this scandal as well.
Well, they won't call themselves counter lobby, they will call you the counter lobby,
yes,
won't they?
That's true.
Because you're lobbying too. I mean,
you're
putting pressure on politicians to do what you think is the right thing.
Yeah.
That's what the others are doing too.
Yeah, we're also involved in lobbying.
But there's more of them, of course.
Yes, there's, for every 10 lobbyists, there's about 9 coming from the business side and about 1 representing trade unions, consumer organizations, civil society. Maybe in some areas too. Like on the environmental area, there's quite a lot of bigger established environmental groups, but in some other areas, there's hardly any civil society lobbying. It's about 80-90% of the lobbyists are from the business side.
Especially in Brussels, apparently.
I'm talking about the Brussels situation. I think on the national level, it's different because there's much more civil society organized at the national level, at least, I think, in Western European countries.
Mm-hmm. You were talking about this obligation now, because just to make it clear for the listeners, a European directive is not just a suggestion, it's something that's binding.
Yeah.
And that's about transparency. But isn't transparency step two? Shouldn't you first have an internationally recognized standard?
There are already some standards.
They are already there.
Just that they're not...
They're not binding.
They're not binding. The limits, of course, of transparency is just the first step. I mean, it's important to get the information so mm-hmm. that both within companies, the management or the shareholders can take action and try to avoid having all these negative impacts, trying to reduce the risks they have on society. So getting the information is important for them. And like we said earlier, it's also important for outsiders, like the consumers, like the workers, like the investors, to get information. But it's not because a company discloses information that they are obliged to have any policy in place. I mean, company could be transparent and say, yes, indeed, in our activities in the Great Lakes region, we extract minerals, and we know that there are issues related to child labor, and there are issues related to the absence of contract. Okay, that's one thing is to say it. But so far, there's no legislation that will say, okay, the next step is that you need to have processes in place to address this. And the third step would be, even if you are transparent, first step, even if you have robust processes in place, which is mm-hmm. the second step, there will always be examples of negative impacts. You can always have examples of or cases of companies which truly are responsible for violating people's rights. And that means that the final step, and we mentioned it several times already, is really for people to have access to court. Mm-hmm. And I think once we will have this transparency, this obligation to put in place the mechanisms to address the risks, and the possibility when rights are violated to go to a court, I think we'll be then much further than we are now in achieving what looks like some corporate accountability.
Mm-hmm. But is it the problem there at the level of the court? I mean, if the principle is that the richest party can pay the best lawyer and will win anyhow, then what use are courts?
That's the situation that I described, which exists in some countries where there is a high level of corruption.
Isn't that everywhere?
There is probably a bias in a lot of countries in the court system. At the same time, I hope to believe that in most Western European countries, there is a relatively independent court. And that if you bring a case to a court in Belgium, that it's more likely that you will get justice as when you do that in a court in Nigeria. But there are a lot of problems which make it at the moment almost impossible to go to that court in Belgium for a Nigerian. Because first of all, it's very expensive and it's quite complicated to actually bring a case. Because you want to go to court against, if it's a Belgian company, against the mother company which is based in Belgium. But then you have to prove that the mother company was fully aware and involved in what was going on in Nigeria. And of course, for an individual citizen, that's very difficult to prove. What we're asking for is actually changing the burden of proof there, because it's obvious that the money that the company makes in Nigeria goes to the headquarters in Belgium, in that example. So why can you then not also assume that there is a direct responsibility? If the money goes there, then also the obligations should go correspondingly. If you bear the benefits of operating there, then you should also take the responsibility for the potential negative consequences.
So one of the aims of this transparency thing is that those mother companies cannot say anymore that they didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, it's really about showing how you affect society. I mean, like in many European directives, you will have loopholes, you will have a lot of flexibility, so mm-hmm. we're not saying that all of a sudden all the relevant information will be published by all the big European companies. But at least that's a new tool for civil society, but for states as well, to be able to reclaim information from companies, to be able to monitor, to check, to look more in depth in some sectors, which we know are sectors with a huge human rights cost. So transparency is a tool. Mm-hmm. It's not going to create any obligation for companies to do well, but they will be obliged to say if they do well or if they indeed have some risks. So in this sense, if it is well enforced, and like many legislations, it's only as good as it is controlled, monitored, sanctioned. So there's a big battle now in many countries because they have still a year to implement these new rules into the national legislation. That's called transposition. And there are big fights because business doesn't want that there would be big sanctions. They don't want that information would be checked. They want to be able to put whatever they want in the reports and say, look, it's up to society to judge whether this is relevant information or not. We don't think it's about NGOs or consumers to make that judgment. It's about having independent verification of this information. Just like for financial reports, I don't think companies would say, oh, I can put whatever I want in a financial report. It's going to be up to people out there to check this. No, no, it's about having independent verification.
And who is going to verify this independently?
States have to put in place the right mechanisms. There are mechanisms to check the financial information. We know that these big auditors, these audit firms like PricewaterhouseCoopers, etc., they will probably quickly see a big market, already see a big market there for checking this kind of information. We don't think that it should be privatized. I don't think these players should be the ones dealing with issues like social rights or environment, etc. So probably, and we know that's the case in some countries, we should create basically a new area, a new kind of actors or players who would be in charge of verifying this information.
And those have to be people with a very high integrity then, because there will be lots of trials to corrupt them, won't there?
Probably, but that's the task of a government. Eh? The task of a government is, if you decide on a rule, then you also need to implement it. And if someone is breaching the rule, then you need to punish. That's the same with stealing. If the rule is you should not steal, then it's the police which are checking people who are potentially stealing. And if they do, then they get punished. That's the same. And so that means that there should be an agency who would oversee the implementation of that rule.
So you are monitoring all those struggles in every European country. That must be fun.
that's quite challenging. But the fact that we are a coalition, we have members in 15 countries, that's of course a good opportunity for us to have some influence on these processes. You know, simply by having meetings where the French, the Polish, the Spanish can discuss, oh, this is what's happening in Spain. Oh, we had this difficulty in our advocacy in France, and this is how we did. I mean, that's the added value of being a coalition, I guess. Instead of having these 15 organizations trying to struggle on their own on how to make the best of this European directive, we try together to set the bar as high as possible, having the convincing arguments, the figures, to counter all the silly arguments made by business, which ultimately you can always summarize by one single argument, which is, leave us alone, that's the best way for us to contribute to a prosperous economy and create jobs. So please don't add any bureaucracy or red tape. That's basically how the whole discussion ends.
Yes,
but we have so many arguments showing that it's not the right way of framing these issues. It's not about this as the short-term cost for companies. It's about the long-term benefit for a greener, more social, more responsible private sector.
So it's great that you can do this, and who's making this possible? Because you are, how many? You have an office here in Brussels?
Yeah, a small office. We are a staff of two.
Of two, but I see three people sitting
here. Oh, we share the office space with two other organizations.
Whoa, okay.
It's more convenient.
So you have two full-time people?
Two full-time people. But I would say we shouldn't reduce ECCJ to this small staff, what we call our secretariat, of which I'm the coordinator. Paul is a good example of the support we get from the members. We have a steering committee of 8 members from different European countries, which are really involved in strategic thinking, planning activities, supporting the organization.
I see. And are those all based in Brussels, or do you also have Skype meetings?
No. So there's some, like my organization, Friends of Youth Europe, is based in Brussels. But most of the members of ECCJ are actually based at the national level. In most countries, it's not individual organizations, but it's platforms. In a lot of countries, groups have already organized themselves around this topic. So you have sometimes 5, sometimes 15, sometimes even more organizations forming a platform on corporate accountability issues. And that platform is then a member of ECCJ. So indirectly, we have very big members, because in some countries, the Oxfam or the Amnesties or the Greenpeace, or there are other organizations with hundreds of thousands of members, are members of these platforms.
So, and do you try to stimulate organizations in countries without a platform to form a platform? Do you think that's a good idea?
That would be, and there are some regions and countries where this would be extremely relevant. In the new European member states, we have some members there, we have some members in Czech Republic, in Poland, but still there, in these countries, it's been more difficult for civil society to create platforms around these issues.
I see.
There is civil society there, not structured in national platforms to work on these corporate accountability issues.
Have you seen the creation of more national platforms over the last 10 years?
Yeah.
Sometimes the platform existed already, but in most countries, ECCJ was at least also contributing to the development of these platforms. Because we said we prefer a platform because we don't want to have four or five different members in a country, because then we might have to decide on which one to work with or not, which one can come to the meeting or not. So that's more up to the organization themselves to decide, and that goes better if it's in a platform. And of course, in a platform, they're stronger.
Of course, but it must be a challenge sometimes if they have a tradition of decennia of being from different factions, or I don't know, like you had in Belgium, what they call the verzuiling. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, where Catholic and socialist organizations or organizations with roots there would never work together before. So that's a challenge in itself, isn't it?
No.
We love challenges.
You're taking on my challenges, so.
You must. Now, you were talking about this new tool, the European Directive, but as I understand it, the big companies will also have a nice new tool, and that's the TTIP.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see it mentioned on your website. Maybe I didn't look long enough, but that seemed like an issue you should really be concerned with.
And we are.
Well, this is not on the European level, of course, which is your main focus, but still.
Right, TTIP as such is not something that ECCJ is working on a lot. I think we're following it. And there are links to also the issues which are important for ECCJ, clearly, because it's about giving rights to investors to operate in European investors in the US and US investors in Europe. And of course, there is also, you see that governments want to give only rights to these investors and not obligations. And this is in sharp contrast with what we are asking. We are asking rights for citizens and obligations for investors or companies.
Mm-hmm.
So in TTIP, the EU wants to do exactly the opposite of what we are asking. So, of course, these two things are linked. But as ECCJ, it's also a bit of a task division, because there are hundreds of organizations working on TTIP already, and the added value of ECCJ is maybe not so big, or we're focusing on a specific element of the negotiations. My own organization, for Friends of the Earth, we are strongly involved in the TTIP campaign, and at the moment it's our biggest campaign. So we have something like almost 10 people working on it, and you might have seen some of our work already, which is the Trojan horse. What we wanted to do at the beginning of the campaign was we said we want to develop something which will symbolize the resistance against this treaty, and then we came with the idea of, okay, this treaty is actually a Trojan horse. It looks nice, but once you have it in, it's going to be disastrous. So we actually had a Trojan horse being built, a plastic Trojan horse of 8 meters high. And this has been very successful because it has been touring around Europe for more than a year now. It has been at almost 50 cities around Europe where the Trojan horse has been exposed in 12 countries.
Strong image.
Strong image, yes, and it has been very successful in becoming the symbol of the resistance against TTIP. And it comes back in newspaper articles and pictures, and so that's a very nice success. But that's not the only thing we do. We also do a lot of research on how TTIP will have negative impacts, for instance, on issues like food. Will we be obliged to eat genetically modified food or chlorinated chicken? Or will we not be able to stop shale gas anymore in Europe if the treaty is there? Or the issue of these investor rights, these tribunals, these private tribunals where companies can...
Well, but that's the thing I wanted to come to, because you can have legislation, but if a company can actually sue a government for harming their profits or their interests by imposing legislation, then where are you going to be with your legislation? It might be deemed illegal by a court that's completely outside of that.
And that's why there's such a huge mobilization, and more than 1 million citizens have signed.
3 million almost.
3 million now.
That's maybe also because of the chickens. But could you still resume what those courts are about? Because they are not normal courts with independent judges, are they?
So it's a system which is called investor-state dispute settlement. So it allows companies to take a state or a government to such a tribunal. If the government does something, and it can be legislation, but it can also be other policy measures, that affect the profitability of that company. So that can be a new environmental standard, that can be nationalizing a company, but it can also be new labor standards, or it can be forbidding advertisements on tobacco packages, this kind of cases. And what is the problem? There's a number of problems. First of all, that a company can actually go to court against a democratically decided decision, which we think is completely wrong. In a democracy, the government, the parliament, and the government are the highest body. They should be able to decide something, and then the company should not be able to challenge that decision. But what is even more problematic is that actually it's not normal courts. So you don't go to the normal courts, but they have set up a whole system of arbitrators, which are all coming from big law firms, which are also big for-profit law firms. The arbitrators earn a lot of money. They cost thousands of euros per hour often. But they all work for law firms that are working for these same companies all the time.
So there won't be a fair trial.
So there is not a fair trial. There's complete lack of transparency. There is no appeal mechanism.
No appeal.
There's no appeal mechanism. And these arbitrators, they can basically, because there is no appeal, they can decide whatever they want. And you see now that the European Commission is trying to limit the power of these arbitrators.
Oh, but they agree with the existence of them.
Yes, they have been doing that for the last 30 years. So, I mean, before that, only since a couple of years, it's the European Commission which signs trade agreements. Before that, it was the member states. But this system exists for 30 or more years. It has never been a problem for governments in Europe, because it was always European companies suing a country like Argentina or Uganda or Mexico or Indonesia or whatever. But now we suddenly see that with the trade agreement with the US, it might be US companies suing the European government. So now,
But something like that happened before. Well, wasn't there a decision in Germany after Fukushima to stop investing in nuclear energy, and weren't they fined by a Swedish company?
No, the case is still running.
Is it?
So Vattenfall, a Swedish energy company, took the German government to one of these tribunals, and they're claiming several billions of euros for the decision of Germany to phase out nuclear energy.
I mean, this is absurd.
It's absurd, yes. And that's also why we're saying this system has to change. If companies are unhappy about something that a government does, then they can go to the normal courts. If a citizen is unhappy about something a government does, then they have to rely on the national courts. A company, a foreign company, should not be treated anywhere differently. They can rely on the national courts, and that's it. So this whole system of giving extra rights to foreign investors is actually the opposite of what we need. We don't need extra rights for them, we need obligations for these companies.
But isn't there something like an international court then?
Yeah, there is an international criminal court, but it is for states.
It is for states. There's not something like that for non-state actors.
In the existing international legal system, even though it's not legally impossible, it's very difficult to drag a company to an international court, or even a European one. We have a European Court of Justice, and you may think that if a European company is alleged to be complicit to a human rights violation, it should be brought to court, but it's not possible. It's only states. So you can sue a state for failing to protect human rights, for example, but you can't actually, in these international and regional courts, sue a company for failing to respect human rights.
Not yet.
Not yet, but that's really the ideas that we may have and we should have in the future international instruments, and with international instruments there should be also international courts or tribunals to complement the national and European ones.
Okay, that's a nice note to end on. I mean, not nice, but...
A clear ending.
So I want to thank you, Jérôme Chaplier and Paul de Clercq, for your time.
Yep, you're welcome.
Thank you.